We should all synchronize our watches. 23 and a half minutes after the hour. You got that, David?
23 and a half.
Don, you got that? 23 and a half minutes?
Okay.
I've got 24 and a half.
Check.
I've got 22.
I got 20 seconds. I'm coming up on
25. All that's the nice thing about having three watches. You just average it out, and you know what time it is. And it works for me.
It's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. And it's a Tuesday, and that means Dr. Don Clark joins us from his, his scientific perch in Garden Valley, Texas, just about 80 miles east of Dallas. And it's a scenic place with hills and green grass and trees and lowing cattle. Do cattle low? Can you hear the lowing going on out there, Don?
They're pretty silent
most
of the time.
Okay.
Yep.
And he grows grapes on his grape ranch at Valle della Pace there in Garden Valley. It's a beautiful place. Don is a biochemist, still by trade. I was almost said used to be a biochemist. Well, you still are a biochemist. You just now apply it differently, don't you?
Yes, it's much more applied science instead of theoretical science.
I picture you working in that, what would you call that wine room where you invent wines? You adjust the sugar content and this and that and this ingredient. It's kind of like cooking, isn't it?
It is, except you're not actually heating things up. You want to keep things cool. Mm-hmm. It's much like the art of cooking, and so you have to maximize the flavors and make sure things are compatible.
And is math applicable to this? I mean, you'd have to do fine measurements of the weights and volumes, I suppose.
Yes, you always are doing things like titrations and seeing how much you need to add of this, and then you have to do the calculations in order to, scale it up to however much wine that you have.
Would you call it chemistry?
It is a type of chemistry, yes. It's a chemistry, it's microbiology. You've got it's art like cooking. You know, there's a lot of tasting that's involved. So there's a lot of different skills that you need to have in order to make a good wine.
Carpentry skills.
Put your thumb out and you kind of say about that much.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, you go by color, and I guess you test for sugar and for other things. So, and then Don has to be a carpenter too, because I've seen his facility there. And he's got a beautiful tasting room and a big covered, I forget what you call that. Not a veranda, not a patio.
Did you figure, did you finish up the pergola?
Oh, it turned out to be a pavilion.
A pavilion?
It's quite large.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Wow.
Yes.
You put walls on it and everything, huh?
No. Oh. No walls. It's open. It's open.
Oh, okay.
And it's David, you don't need walls in Texas, David.
Oh, okay.
You don't need insulation.
My definition of a pergola is you don't have walls on it. It's open to the blue sky.
Okay.
But a pavilion has got walls and a door and.
Oh well, yeah. It doesn't have that. It's an open area.
Okay.
We have the space for quite a lot of seating and for entertaining.
Yeah.
And so it's a beautiful space. Actually, a lot of people have complimented us on it.
I'm going to have to come by and see it firsthand. I've seen pictures of it. Don, we're going to talk this morning about a Breakpoint article. In fact, for those listeners interested, there's a link to the Breakpoint article in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com. That's one of the longest links I've ever seen. But if you click on it, it'll take you to the article. This is kind of heady stuff. It has to do with intelligent design. And Don, there's a sentence in this I want to kind of start off with here. I'm going to read it to you. It talks about the assumption that the world of science makes, that is, if something cannot be defined, it says that this presumption is that creationism, intelligent design, and other claims of supernatural intervention in the origin of life or species is not science because they are not testable by methods of science. And, of course, John Stonestreet in his article writes, well, that assumption isn't testable by science either. But what if the claims of design are testable. And a lot of this kind of goes back to the assumption that religion and creationism and intelligence is all mumbo jumbo. It's like made up because you can't apply math to it. It's like the but we know that what they call supernatural is eminently natural, is it not?
Oh, it's the supernatural. Here's a basic supernatural principle that the supernatural is expressed in the natural.
Mm.
And so when you're looking at the natural, after all, God says, look around, look at my creation. Look at the stars and the heavens, because the heavens declare the glory of God. So, and he made us in his own image, which part of that image is creativity and figuring things out. And so we have the ability to figure things out. Now, we can't figure everything out because we have finite brains and we live in a finite world. But we can figure a lot of the stuff out, and we certainly have the capability of figuring out, hey, this looks, not only it looks like it's designed, it is designed. And we can then come up with definitions of what, design might be. And a lot of folks have done that and said, there's no way you can look at the things around us, especially in biology, and say that it's not designed. And even David Hawking himself said, let me see if I can get his...
Richard Dawkins, you're talking about the...
Richard Dawkins. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he said that, the study of completed things that gives the appearance of having been designed for a purpose gives, so the evolutionists saying, it just gives the appearance of design. It really, really isn't designed because we can't put, the supernatural in things, and we can't have a designer, although everything that we build, of course, has been designed. I mean, the computers that we use and the internet and the automobiles and airplanes and everything else is designed, and we can look at that and obviously say, oh, that must have been designed, instead of, it having to come together by random chance. But when we look at biological life, or we look at, the way the heavens are arranged, and the planets and the stars and the galaxies and all of this, and they're arranged, we say, oh, that just came together by chance, which is absolutely foolishness, because within biological systems and within, the heavens, for example, we can see, so much order and so much well-defined structures that you have to say that, gee, it goes beyond the belief to say that just came together, by chance.
No, we could call it fine tuning. It's everything is an incredible balance that indicate. And what Richard Dawkins says kind of goes against that saying that, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. In other words, what we observe empirically leads us to right conclusions. Not necessarily wrong conclusions, although we can make mistakes. But how much does empirical evidence have to do with this? Does this go beyond that?
Oh, it goes beyond that. We have the tools now to delve, completely within a cell and take the components apart and say, this is so highly fine-tuned. You were starting to use that term before that, it had to be, designed. Everything, and Michael Behe was one of the earlier mathematicians, if you will, molecular biologists that said, there were irreducible complexities in biology that you couldn't explain by random chance. Because if you take out any one of the components, in this case, mainly proteins, for example, out of the system, the system doesn't work and therefore doesn't do the organism that it's in any benefit. His study was of the rotary motor that is in a flagella bacteria. The flagella, or the little tail on the bacteria, actually spins at incredible speeds, like 100,000 RPMs, and it can stop on a dime and then spin in the opposite direction that fast as well. So the rotary engine is extremely efficient inside this thing. And if you look at the bacteria that is now mobile because of the flagella, and you say, okay, we're just going to take out one of the proteins in the rotary motor, and then the rotary motor is not going to work, that does absolutely no good to the bacteria. And the bacteria just sits there, and it'll digest the food around it, but it can't digest the food someplace else because it can't get there. And so, there's a major problem with the system, and the bacteria indeed would die without the flagella, without the rotary motor. So that is irreducible complexity. And so therefore, that system could not have evolved. That was the logic behind it. Well, there was a group of scientists that wrote an article in the Journal of Theoretical Biology, and from Norway and Stockholm University, Norway's University of Thrones, and from Stockholm University, and they came up with this concept, very similar to irreducible complexity, that biological systems are fine-tuned. They're so fine-tuned that from a statistical point of view, it's impossible to have these systems be this fine-tuned and not have been designed. So in a nutshell, that was their conclusion. Much like anybody who delves into this from an open mind, you come to that conclusion that this stuff just can't come together by random chance. So the arguments against it, the evolutionists try to have arguments against that and say such things as, well, we've got a pool of experiments going on in life called evolution, and of course some systems are going to survive and some systems aren't going to survive in this pool, and so the ones that do survive then are better tuned than the ones that aren't survived. And the evolutionists kind of wave their hand and wave it on by that no, this can't be intelligent design because we've got this pool. Well, that's exactly what these scientists, determined was that pool couldn't exist with this such fine tuning. And so they kind of argue themselves out of it. But when you actually, look at it from an honest point of view, you come up even with the stars and the galaxies and the space that we have, you come up with this same conclusion that it is not random chance that we have the systems that we have. It is not only gives the appearance of design, it is designed. Well, that leaves you with a problem, of course, from a point of view of an evolutionist, because if it is designed, it must mean that there is a designer, and then leaves you, well, who is the designer? And of course, that gets you into the supernatural, because this is a physical world we live in. And if it's designed, the designer has to be outside of this space-time domain that we live in, and therefore you're left with the creator designer, of course, who is none other than God, you know, himself and Jesus Christ himself, because he spoke things into existence.
What's the difference then between intelligent design and creationism?
Well, intelligence design does not specify who the creator is. Creationism says the creator, at least Christian creationism, of course, says the creator is God, and we know who the creator is. The one who spoke things into the existence is Jesus. The one who spoke us into existence is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. It took all three of them to make us in God's image, because we are made in his image, unlike the animals. And so we know from Genesis chapter 1, when we went through, you know, that series, we know who the creator is. So we can point to the creator, whereas intelligent design doesn't go that far and just says there's a designer. We don't know who the designer is. That's up for you, up to you to figure that out. So there is a designer, but we haven't identified who the designer
is. Well,
that's
perilously close to pure evolutionism, isn't it? Then, because it says there's something we can't possibly define, understand. We can't express mathematically, but we just know there's something there. Evolution does the same thing. They say there's a Big Bang, or then they can't explain that, or they can't explain how you get something from nothing, but it must have happened because evolution is true.
Well, it's not that necessarily evolution is true. It's that, well, we exist, so therefore it must have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know all of the ins and outs, but because we are here, and we can think about these things, therefore, it exists. Intelligent design, the intelligent design effort was put into place to point folks towards a creator, and to try to get intelligent design curriculum, let's say, into the school systems. So it was an attempt to point folks in the right direction. If creationists said that doesn't go far enough, you got to name the creator. It doesn't, because it leaves people hanging. You're kind of teasing them that, oh yes, it looks like there is a creator, but you don't quite get there. And the evolutionists complain because they say, oh, it's pointing to a supernatural being, and we can't have that because science we got to separate ourselves. It just has to be materialistic, and a supernatural being isn't materialistic by our definition, of course. It's kind of funny because the evolutionist's definition, of being materialistic, you can't have material, any materialism, anything physical without having a creator who said, let there be light in the very beginning. So even the very first point of the materialistic world that we live in, you can't even have the first step of that without having a creator. But the evolutionists want to, of course, completely cut out any presuppositions that there was a supreme being. So it left the intelligent design effort, if you will, kind of in limbo, not really friends with the creation world, and not really, certainly not friends with the evolutionary world, because they fought like a Dickens to keep it out of schools, and therefore we don't have a intelligent design curriculum anymore. These books that were written excellently, philosophically and mathematically and biologically, beautiful explanations of life and how things, came about, from either a philosophical point of view or from a mathematical point of view. But the only people that were buying them, in a sense, were the homeschoolers and the Christians.
You fought that battle personally, didn't you? You went to war with school districts.
Yes. I defended, actually, I was pointing out some major, major errors in biology textbooks. When every 10 years, Texas goes through a review of various curriculum. And this one particular year, the biology textbooks were up. And so I took one little aspect of one of the chapters in one of the biology textbooks, the new textbooks, and, said, this makes absolutely no sense. We have proven that this is wrong. Why is it in the biology textbook? And normally they would give you, I think, like 2 minutes to present your case. Well, I had written the paper on it, and I handed it to the folks. And then, I was explaining the paper, and my two minutes went up. And they, as long as they keep asking questions, you can answer the questions. So my 2 minutes went almost to 5 or 10 minutes. With them asking, asking the questions about why this particular aspect in this biology book was incorrect. They might take up history the next year or physics or whatever
who
happens.
Who are they? Who's making those decisions?
It was a school board. It was a Texas State School Board that's making the decisions. But the problem is here in Texas, the school board had given over the task to the liberal, academic group, Teachers Association. And so the Teachers Association chose the textbooks. And
the teachers union.
Yes, exactly.
Ah, gotcha.
The school board would then ultimately rule, but of course you didn't have a whole lot of conservatives on the school board either. And this is the reason why we as Christians need to be involved in this process, because if we leave it, which unfortunately we have, leave education to, the liberals, they're always going to teach you garbage and teach you nonsense instead of, true hard facts teach you the truth. And that's what was happening, of course, in biology, and it happens in history, it happens in every particular subject. You wouldn't think that math, for example, would be a controversial topic. But the way you ask a math question and do word problems is a way to influence a child's thinking and his philosophy upon life. And, stuff like that has crept into and now is inundated into our systems we've got a lot of work to do in order to back all of this stuff up. But this
you bring up mathematics. To me, that's a universal truth. I mean, there's just no equivocating about mathematics. You can interpret things differently, but if it's in a mathematical formula that's proven, it is. I mean, it's fact. Does math apply to biology?
Oh, well, you can describe biological. You can describe, depending on the type of math, of course, you can describe anything by mathematics. I mean, that's mathematics as you say, a universal description of various things. So, of course, you can think of physics and physics, you throw an object and you can describe the trajectory of the object in a mathematical term.
Well, what I want you to define is this: you can't invent math; you can only discover it, because the relationships between things that it explains are already there. They're already in place.
They're in place. You can come up with new mathematical techniques to describe the world, for example, and the various elements of the world. And so, we had algebra and trigonometry and those type of things. But in order to describe movement in various other aspects and areas and volumes and everything, we had to go to calculus, which was in essence, a new math back then. But, of course, it's commonplace now, the way you have integral calculus or differential calculus. It doesn't matter. But in differential calculus,
was Isaac Newton's great contribution, no? Isaac Newton's great contribution was inventing the calculus.
I'm not 100% sure on that. It's a possibility, but I'm not 100% sure. But, be that as it may, as we go on, I mean, we're inventing new techniques, matrices and matrix algebra and various other things to be able to help describe the world around us. And it can get quite complex. So then computers came along where we can solve a lot of complex calculations, for example, very, very quickly, assuming you can program the computer model. Well, if you can express it in the math terms, you can solve the computer model. I mean, you can solve the mathematical model with the computer. So that's what came in. And these folks that we were talking about in this article used math in order to say that the systems are very, very fine-tuned. So yes, you can use math and various types of math to describe biological systems, to describe behaviors, but statistics is even the weather, for example. There's going to be a 50% chance of rain. Well, where did the 50% come in?
Yeah, I've asked that of meteorologists, and basically they shrug their shoulders. Is it 50% of the time, 50% of the area? Is it a matter of odds? Is it gambling? Is it what? What does it mean?
Well, no, it's statistics. It's statistics. Yeah. It's based on we're going to project where this weather front is, the direction it's going to go in, and because we know where it's been, and then there are very complex computers and computer models then that model and show you when you go, for example, you can go on satellite images, and now you can actually see the progression of the storm before it actually gets there. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a mathematical model based on where it's been and based on wind speeds and temperatures and all this other stuff. They can now predict, not 100% accuracy, because it's extremely
complex. Pretty impressive, though. There's another question I'd like you to expound upon here a little bit, and this is where philosophy and science blend. We talked about evolution, intelligent design, creationism. Is there room in creationism for someone who will accede to the creation story but not be a Christian?
Wow, that's a good question, because an honest person would ask, is going to ask, who is this creator? Who is the designer? And you can put it off as long as possible. You can say, well, I don't know. I mean, it may be the Christian God. It may be somebody else. But we can't know. But in fact, we can know, because our our Christian God is a very personal God, and he lets you know who he is. He says those who diligently seek him will find him. So if you're diligent about it, you can find him. So it's a very very interesting question. I think some people put it off and don't quite get there because perhaps not wanting to know the answer to the question.
Well, there's that Oswald Chambers concept of the God-shaped hole in everybody's heart. There's only one answer for it, only one satisfactory solution to that, and that's creationism and the God that loves you and has a plan and a purpose for you and expressed to us in Jesus Christ. So, Don, thanks very much. Appreciate always what you bring to the broadcast, and we've learned something today, I suspect, and we'll dwell on that for a while, and look forward to your conversation next week, okay?
Okay, very good.
Thank you, Don.
Have a great week.
Bye-bye.